Mr. Sherwood, Reel 3.
So carrying on, I think my last words were that for about a year after this operation on Rhodes, we continued to live in the Medway, to scramble with a great deal of jealousy for any jobs going, because jobs tended to be few and far between, mainly because the authorities were reluctant to become interested in the sort of work that we could do, despite all Roger Courtney's efforts to get us better accepted. I think I'm right in saying that there was more enthusiasm shown by the Navy to have us around than there was by the Army. Anyway, as I said earlier, we spent the next year in Medway carrying out various operations, going out with submarines, sometimes on spec, on one of their full wartime patrols, which used to last anything up to 3 weeks of those times, maybe two of us with one foul boat, without an officer, which greatly intrigued a senior naval officer I met many years later. How could they let blokes like you, other ranks, corporals, lance corporals and the rest, loose on operations like this without an officer? He didn't mean it in a nasty way, but he was intrigued. Later on, every operation was headed up by an officer. But to begin with, we were just said, well, you two are going out on that op, you're going out with that submarine, leaving so-and-so, and you're going to do this or that, whatever it was, or you're going on spec and taking the canoe, and if the commander of the submarine sees something ashore that he thinks could justify some action by you blokes, then you're under his command. And this worked very satisfactorily. Snag was that any operations we did were possibly just a one-off, one night. And we then had to suffer everything the submarine might suffer on a normal offensive wartime patrol, attacking enemy shipping and being depth charged and so on, which always wasn't always amusing, and in fact very frightening, if I'm truthful about it. I don't think anybody else being depth charged found it very amusing either. The Navy might have been more used to it than we were, though I doubt anybody could really get used to that very unpleasant form of being sort of bombed underwater and unable to do anything about it, and unable to get away from it very quickly either, because you could only creep about at 1.5-2 knots on the electric motors, which didn't give you a great turn of speed for getting away from the destroyers which were looking for you up on the top. Anyhow, we were stuck with this and made the best of it. For the rest of a patrol, we'd volunteer for as lookouts on the bridge, a good opportunity to get some fresh air at night when the submarine was on the surface charging her batteries for the next day's dive run. We'd take a turn on the fore or after plane controls, the things which keep the submarine going up or down in the main control room. Sometimes helping with decoding in the wireless office, and anything else we were asked to do. And this relieved the boredom, as well as making us more acceptable to the sailors on board, having two soldiers sort of lying around in their bunks all day when the sailors were on three watches continuously, wasn't very acceptable, so we got stuck into anything that we could do to help.
Where was all this work taking place?
The submarines were operating out of Alexandria from the Medway, in covering the eastern Mediterranean, as far as an overlap with the 10th Flotilla, which operated out of Malta, and they covered that part of the Mediterranean. The operations that we did, and were quite a number, but very small, and very few of them were offensive ones from our side, were carried out over that 12 months that I mentioned earlier. And the type of operation we did, we were told to get, we were going out, was landing to carry out a reconnaissance of some particular area of the coast that somebody wanted information on, behind the enemy line along the North African coast, or the Libyan coast rather, Egyptian-Libyan coast, and putting agents ashore. Agents, Greeks, Yugoslavs, Even a Pole on one occasion, that what the devil he was doing going ashore in Greece I never discovered. We were not involved in any, as I said, offensive operations. The people we put ashore were involved as far as we ever knew, but we were never told much for obvious reasons in case of capture. They were on sabotage operations, and they took wireless sets and explosive and money, all sorts of stuff done up in sealed biscuit tins. And the ones we had to do with were Greeks or Cretans, as I say, one Pole. Whether these chaps ever came back, we never discovered. They were dressed, they went ashore in civilian clothes, and on one occasion where we did a landing that I was myself personally involved in, on the plains of Marathon, of the coast of Greece, the chap got into the canoe wearing an ordinary Burberry-type raincoat, a soft grey felt hat, collar, tie and everything else, and shoes, just as though he was going out for a walk or a shopping expedition into the town. He lowered himself into the canoe dressed like this. I was in uniform, obviously, waiting to be paddled ashore about a mile to the shore from the submarine. The other end, having done a reconnaissance during the day through the periscope, but very brief looks, because obviously you couldn't keep a periscope sticking up above the water a mile off enemy coast without any risk to the submarine. So you're allowed very brief looks just to get the lie of the land and hope you'd retain an impression of it for sufficiently long when you came to land on it that night. And also to see if there were any obvious enemy posts to be avoided. And having got on the shore with these chaps, we made two journeys, two of us, each with a canoe, each with our civilian in front of us, ourselves paddling for the back, landed on the beach, quiet, dark night, no moon, fortunately a fairly calm sea, and out they stepped as though they were getting out of a pleasure rowboat at a seaside resort and got onto the beach, unloaded the gear they'd brought with them, hid it under bushes, and vanished, and we returned to the submarine. That was a typical operation of that kind of landing agents.
Did they seem to be British or Greek?
They were Greek. There were two British we landed on another operation on the south, an earlier operation on the south coast of Crete, in a bay, Sansuro Bay. I remember that name very well. I've got sketches of it still somewhere. These were two Cretans and two British, a British officer and a British sergeant. I can't remember their names for the life of me. But I can remember the name of one of the Cretans. He looked like a bandit. He was as broad as he was tall. He had a massive black beard. He had a bandolier, real bandit style thing slung over his shoulder, ditto with his belt full of rounds of ammunition, a rifle slung over his shoulder when he got ashore, and he was called Satanas, which we were told was the local name for Satan. Well, it seemed to us very appropriate. And we had the job of putting this chap ashore with his accomplice, who was a twice convicted murderer who'd escaped from Crete and was going back, we presume, with qualifications of murderer, to see if he could murder a few Germans this time instead of his own countrymen. A very affable, amiable bloke who spoke a bit of English, spent a fair amount of time with us in our particular quarters in the submarine. The old bandit fellow with the beard spent most of his time in the wardroom with the officers, not drinking or anything like that, but just with them. I suppose the murderer was considered as another rank, and Satanask was considered as an officer or something like that.
How did you know he was a murderer?
Satanas told us. Well, he told the submarine officers, and they told us, that chap you've got out, they better watch him. He's a twice convicted murderer. Didn't make any difference to us. He wasn't going to murder us anyway. A quiet sort of bloke. He may have had very good reasons for murdering whoever it was he murdered. We didn't go into it. We didn't discuss it with him, obviously. And his English was very limited, but enough for the sort of communication that we needed.
So these operations went on 41 to 42?
41 into 42. operating from the Medway.
And how close to the enemy did you come on any of these operations?
On the one where we landed these two chaps on the plain of Marathon, there was a large German outpost about half a mile away from our landing point, which was identified through the periscope, flying a big Nazi flag, easily seen. So we knew that was there, and we were landing about half a mile from it, and were duly careful, but saw nobody. There was no sign of any sort of patrol by night on the part of the Germans. We didn't bump them at all. Indeed, our role was not to bump the enemy. Your job is to avoid them because of the sort of people you're putting ashore. It compromised the whole thing, and certainly compromised these civilians walking around in the dark with their Burberry-type raincoats, soft hats on, and so forth. I never bumped the enemy at all there, except on one occasion, and that was when we'd left the Medway and taken up our quarters ashore. Our role operating from submarines rather came to an end after about a year. Indeed, I think it was rather less than a year. And we then had to find other means of getting to our targets and ended up using motor torpedo boats. A quick dash up the coast, again by night, obviously. Two or three canoe full. Six blokes, three canoes, the motor torpedo boat heaving to about a mile off the shore, hopefully so as not to be heard, because the engines of those things at full throttle, you could hear for miles, and huge open exhausts from the stern.
Well, why was it the changeover made from submarines to MTBs?
I honestly don't think I can remember. I think perhaps the Navy had exhausted the possibilities. We got the impression that they had enough of us. It can't have been as simple as that, though. And of course, as other ranks, we didn't know the ins and outs and the comings and goings of things. It may have been because the situation in Europe or in Greece or in Crete was changing, for instance, not necessitating the landing of agents and such like people anymore. Because after that, our operations were confined to a lot of very abortive efforts to land along the coast of Egypt and Libya at the time when the Germans were at El Alamein. Just going back a bit to the submarine operations, there was a period when the British collapsed in Crete after the invasion of Crete by the Germans. Enormous numbers of British were stuck, abandoned, left in Crete, and had to be got out. And the submarines did a lot of very successful operations, assisted by SBS personnel, chaps with us on the Medway. I didn't go on one, I went on a similar one, but a different place later. Bringing off, up to 30 and 40 blokes, there by pre-arrangement. Through a contact made, I know not how, presumably through some sort of Crete underground, aimed at getting these chaps down to various rendezvous points on the south coast of Crete, ready for embarkation on a certain night, alternatively, another night if the first night failed for any reason. And these were quite successful. They brought quite a number of chaps off. But I never did one of those, not against Crete. I did one quite separately against a small or on a small island of Gavdos, which lies about 25 miles south of Crete, where whilst on patrol in the Triumph submarine, I think it was, we heard through radio signal to the submarine there were some British troops supposed to have escaped to this island from Crete, and would we go and investigate and bring them off if they were there. And
escape from where?
From Crete, after the collapse of Crete. They'd got themselves across to Gavdos. There was myself and another chap, and both of us were bursting ourselves to be first to get onto this island. The whole idea of landing on an island seemed to come first rather than what else might develop. the first landing, a night landing, we tossed a coin in the end to see who should go. And to my great frustration, I lost the toss, and the other chap went ashore with a young naval sub-lieutenant in charge. And they did a reconnaissance. They went inland, they visited a village, and came off without getting any wind of anybody ashore at all, whether British or anybody else except the villagers. How they communicated with these blokes on this island, I had no idea. Next morning, I'd gone to lie down. And I was suddenly shaken and told I was wanted in the control room, the captain of the submarine. And he said, and the submarine was lying on the surface by now in broad daylight. He said there was a group of blokes ashore, and ashore was no more than a quarter of a mile from the submarine, which was floating in placid water. You could see the bottom, it was so clear. She was almost aground. Get in your fall boat, go in and see who they are, and find out about them, and bring back a message, or arrange for them to come ashore, aboard, or whatever's necessary. So full of excitement, almost incoherent with excitement, I jumped into this ruddy canoe on my own, only to find there was a stiff breeze blowing across the bay. And I had a hell of a job to keep the head of them. They were about 18 feet long, these canoes, and very light. If you had no weight in the bow, the least bit of wind would blow them one way or the other. So I ended up crabbing across the bay, paddling desperately, my mouth getting drier and drier, I can remember, with the excitement of it all. At the last minute, one of the submariners had lent me a 4-5 revolver with a lanyard, which I tied roughly around my middle. I got to the beach. The canoe was grabbed by these blokes, hauled up. I stepped out of it. The 4-5 pistol came adrift and fell in the sand. So whoever they were, I was defenseless at that moment. Completely amateurish exercise, really. And none of them seemed to be able to speak English, and they were all in civilian clothes, and they all looked Greek types. They were certainly not British types. One of them could speak a little English, and it soon transpired that these were communists who'd been exiled from some time before by the Greek government on this island and left there to make out as best they could. And would I go back to the submarine and get them off? There were no British there. That was made quite clear. And they were all very affable and friendly, and with much handshaking and some hilarity over the fate of the 4-5 pistol, by now covered in sand and seawater. So I paddled back to the submarine, told the skipper what it was all about, and he said, nothing doing. And he said, we'd better get out of here, because it was a brilliant sunny morning with a clear blue sky, and across the water you could see the snow-covered mountains of Crete, full of Germans, and he was apprehensive that we'd be spotted by aircraft. And we backed out of the bay, dived when we could, and that was the end of it. He wouldn't bring these guys off. It wasn't good enough for him to, communists or anybody else, civilians, you know, they're Greeks, that's their Shari, they stay there.
Their what?
Shari, their problem. It's a Swahili term. Shari, somebody's Shari. And there they were left. And in due course, we returned to Alexandria. On another occasion, we were lying off Benghazi, again in the Triumph. There were two of us. The skipper sent for us, and he said, there's a ship in the harbour which you two blokes can go and try and sink if you feel like it. It was a very casual sort of, airy sort of, have a go if you want. We had limpet minds with us by this time. These things which looked rather like, you may have seen them somewhere, shaped like a service tin hat with the brim cut off, stuffed full of explosive with magnetic feet underneath. And the theory was that you got up alongside a ship in the dark and put these on the hull below the waterline, set off a fuse of varying lengths of time according to how long you felt you wanted to get away yourself, and in due course, if you were successful, the ship blew up and sank. So we'd had no experience of handling these ruddy things at all. One or two of us had been set to practicing swimming with them on our backs in Alexandria Harbour, but that was all. It was terribly amateurish, really. So we said, right, we'll have a go. With some apprehension, I must admit. Anyways, and this was by day, so he had a look through the periscope, and we'd had a look through the periscope, and there was the ship. I think she was called the Ram 2, R-A-M-B, Ram 2, I seem to remember. And there's your target. By nightfall, the scene had changed, or dusk, the scene had changed, and the skipper had decided, rather than send us ashore, it was far easier to fire a torpedo at this bally thing from the submarine and sink it that way, and proceeded to do so. So we didn't get ashore, which was probably just as well. We probably wouldn't have come back. I don't think we would have come back anyhow. A hairy sort of operation.
And what was the date of that?
Oh, crikey. Sometime during 42. May, June, perhaps, I'm guessing. If it was really vital to know that, I could probably look it up in diary somewhere, but I can't lay my hands on that right now. It would have been round about then.
And the Gavdos one would have been about May or June 41?
It would. 41, did I say 42 a little while ago?
Yes. You mean they were both...
No. Sorry, I'm misleading you. I'm getting my dates right. On thinking again about this, the failed Benghazi operation took place before Crete fell. The operations that I referred to earlier against Crete and Greece, the plains of Marathon, took place obviously after the fall of Crete, and the Germans occupied both Greece and Crete.
And the fall of Crete was May 41.
Right, right. We're talking of 1941, not, as I said earlier, I think, 1942.
Can you give any details about any other operations that stick in your mind?
I can give details of one partly successful one carried out from a motor torpedo boat long before Alamein. The Germans were at Alamein, in fact, and when practically everything had been evacuated from Alexandria, the heavy units of the Royal Navy had sailed south through the Suez Canal. The only forces left in Alex were maybe one or two destroyers and a lot of motor torpedo boats. The army was busy burning its files and records in Cairo. There was a great air of defeatism around at the time. I can remember very clearly, it was perfectly appalling, the talks of evacuation up into Palestine. Too much talk of evacuation. And this registered on us at our rather lowly level. We were, even down at the Suez Canal, we were miles from the action. We weren't allowed to go anywhere, even to the lavatory, without carrying our rifles and our haversacks, which had a basic change of clothing and a pair of socks, and that was all. The rest of the kit was packed and stored in a tent, presumably ready for evacuation to Palestine when the time came as well. Now, that period, where everybody else seemed to be talking of pulling out, the SBS went the reverse direction and went up to Alexandria, where the officers had managed to get themselves in a civilian billet outside one of the suburbs of Alexandria, and were proposing to carry out a number of offensive operations against the Germans, who by then were a whole way along the coast of Alamein, using motor torpedo boats as a means of getting in. Well, a number of attempts were made to do this. Only one, to my recollection, was partly successful. The others were abortive for various reasons. But we went up one night, couldn't get ashore because there was a too heavy a surf running, for instance, and came back to Alexandria and were back in Alex the next morning. There were conditions like that which dogged a lot of these operations, weather conditions. And these canoes being rather flimsy things did depend on the weather being reasonably good, reasonably calm seas. Although later, soon after this, we struck another condition altogether. Or earlier than that, I'm getting things a bit out of context. But on this particular occasion, when we went back up the coast, and who had selected the landing place, I know not, turned out to be a larger German camp. The MTV crept in, We had one foal boat and an enormous blow-up raft, a sort of RAF rescue-type raft, which probably held six men, two chaps in the foal boat. And in this contraption, we sort of gyrated our way gently towards the shore from the MTB, which unfortunately had been heard from the shore. And within moments of actually landing on the beach, very lights were fired, which lit up the whole area, miles around. A gun opened fire out to sea in the direction of the MTB. And our reaction was, somebody is sure to see us. I don't remember any of us were particularly apprehensive, I think back. We still proceeded to land on the beach. We couldn't see anybody moving about, but this gun was still firing. The very lights went out, the gun stopped firing, presumably having realized that whatever was there had sheared off. And we expected to be picked up on the beach just like that, you know, we expected to be Germans running all over the place, up and down looking for people. Nothing happened. And our object on this occasion was to plant dollops of explosive, plastic high explosive, filled with thermite, which was a black powder which caught fire very easily and continued blazing. Thermite bombs, we call them, with a fuse in them. And the idea was to creep around the camp and stick these things on the petrol tanks of any lorries we happened to come across. Nobody knew for sure whether there were lorries there or not. But any we found, the idea was stick a plastic bomb in the petrol tank with a time fuse and get out again. I went off with one other bloke. We split up into twos with no particular plan. We had two officers with us, but there was no plan was drawn up, just sort of, you go that way, you go there, you go there, and rendezvous back here on the beach at 0200 or whatever it was. So it was left to us as individuals to take action if we thought we could take it, and if we thought we couldn't, not to take it, not to give the game away. Despite the very lights and the gun firing, which you would have thought would have raised the whole camp and everybody would have been out. But again, there was no sign of life at all. So with my colleague, we shoved off up through some sand hills. The beach was edged by a low bluff, probably 50 or 60 feet high, sand bluff. And we edged our way up the sand hill to the edge of this bluff. And just as we got to the edge of it, and we were about to scramble over the top, we saw what looked to us as a giant figure approaching along the cliff edge, silhouetted against the starlight. Again, it was a moonless night. And realized this was a German sentry. We could see if he had a rifle slung over his shoulder. And he was looking around in a rather casual way, and now and again looking over the edge of the bluff. So we just waited, crouched down like a couple of rabbits in the sand there, with our pistols ready to drop this bloke if he should spot us. He came on and he stood as near as I am to you. He was up on the bluff, the top of the bluff here, and we were sort of crouched down, and he never saw us.
And I'm about 4 feet away from you.
That's all. And he was totally unaware of our presence, despite all the uproar earlier on, where, as I said, you would have thought the whole camp would have been a seething mass of activity. And he just turned around and walked back the way he'd come. All this had taken time.
By what method would you have killed him?
Just shot him. There's no other method we could have done. We weren't equipped with any of these fighting knives or garrotting wires or anything like that. We'd have just shot him. We would have then had to take a chance.